to go back and talk about the paper mills again, the problems with the water, did you sort those out?
We did, yes.
At the time?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you tell me how you did that?
Well, the paper making is very demanding on water and on energy. The energy they used to bring in, what's called bunker oil, it was very thick oil like tar, and that seemed to work all right. But the water came from Brittas, two ponds in Brittas, and it was monitored by, they had a water bailiff. He was employed by the paper mills. He lived up there, and he used to regulate the water. The water then was, they had a treatment plant, a permeability treatment plant, and the water was treated. And it was then allowed to go into the River Camac until they had to put in a flocculator, which was a plant for to take the paper, the pulp out of the paper, out of the water. And it was still fairly dirty going into the Camac. And at the demise of the Clondalkin paper mills, FMI were sent for, including myself, over the pollution of the Camac. And that was sorted out by FMI having to pay an effluent license, a meter of the effluent going into the Camac, which was quite heavy. They also had to pay for any water they took other than what came out of the paper mills. At that time, there was always sort of problems with drought in the summertime when it was a shortage of water. But it was always solved. But there was also the problem of users of the Camac River downstream, the likes of Killeen paper mills. And if the paper mills were doing coloured papers, it would affect Killeen paper mills. And in fact, I remember one day when the managing director of Clondalkin paper mills rang up Killeen paper mills and said they were running red. That was meaning that the water was going down was red. But it had been running for a couple of hours beforehand. So and that was the range. That was the life they lived, you know, see. And but the council at the arrival of FMI, that changed completely, you know. And now the Camac is in the lovely clean river with fish and everything. And
but there was no at that time. There was nobody said anything. The council, were they alerted to this, the fact that the water was red going down the river?
No, the council were in O'Connell Street at that time. They'd have moved up to Talla now, you see. They have a hands-on now.
And but there was no local complaints or anything. But then the water wasn't... nobody was drinking that water, obviously. And
No, but you have to remember, Clondalkin paper mills, they employed maybe 550 or 600 people, and then contractors and everything else, drivers and trucks. It was a big industry, you know.
And they weren't going to do anything to rock the boat.
Don't rock the boat. Yes, that was the theory then, you know what I mean. But as we got more effluent, the times changed, you know.
Do you recall the time when the Clondalkin group organised themselves? Do you remember that time when the Clondalkin paper mills started to amalgamate with other companies?
They didn't amalgamate. They bought them.
They bought out the companies.
Bought out the companies. Yeah, bought them out. I'm not so sure when they bought these paper mills. Drimna paper mills and Swiftwood, they weren't really asset, they were asset stripping, you know what I mean? They were getting rid of the opposition, you see.
So that's what really, they weren't interested in keeping them running as such. They brought the workers in. Was that for convenience sake, you know, to bring them all in here to Clondalkin.
I'm talking. No, the workers didn't come to Clondalkin. They were redundant.
They were left redundant.
Yes, but yeah. They just closed the plants down.
But I'm thinking of
Drimna Paper Mills.
Drimna Paper Mills.
Yes.
Did they? The workers there came in, didn't they? Or did they? Maybe they didn't.
I know one engineer came up, a fellow called Pence, but these would have been fairly old people, you know what I mean? And technology and everything was changing, you know what I mean? And
But acid stripping, that's what it was called.
I mean, Swiftwood Paper Mills now is a big apartment complex, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not so sure that Mansfield got some of that property or is involved in some of that property, you know?
I see.
Yeah. But that's near City West, you know?
Yes. But it's quite interesting, you know, when you talk about engineering from your day to what engineering is today.
Yeah,
it's,
but we had to move different. With it, you see.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the, you know, when you look back at it, were we behind other countries or were we as good as other countries?
We were as good as other countries, yeah. Do you know who owned the paper mills? Originally.
No, you better tell me all that now.
It was a big insurance company that owned it. Well, it was on the stock exchange. I can't think of the name of the insurance company. But that's who owned it.
Okay.
And some of those boys there now would tell you that they would be at the management level who really owned them, you know. They were quoted on the stock exchange. I haven't heard anything about them recently at all, you know.
Yeah.
The last dealings I had with them was when I bought the pulp plant of this man Lund. And Lund was, he was director of Irish Cement as well. And he was based up here on the Monastery Road up in Sayak. They had an office up there. When the mill closed, have you been where the paper mill is?
Yes.
There's a pool hall, pool place across the road from the, that was the offices.
Yes.
The offices was there, and the paper mills was where the mill centre was, you know.
Yeah.
They're very innovative people. The Mankids were very, they used to make paper during the war with straw and the old rags and things like that, you know, brown paper. I don't know if you ever, years and years ago, you get an old brown paper bag and you'd see the flecks of grain and worried you.
Yeah, I do. I remember that.
That's what was going on at that time.
But the quality of the native tree that was being cut down and brought in.
Yeah.
That wasn't really suitable, was it?
No,
paper making.
No, it was fairly rough. They had to, it come in 2 meter lengths, you know, just like that, and it had to be debarked.
Yeah.
And then they had a boiler then for burn the bark for to raise the stem, and it was fairly troublesome. And the pulp, be like a wet beer mat now, to be honest with you, you know, whereas the stuff now be coming in from Sweden for newsprint and stuff like that, be, you know, quality paper, you know.
Yeah.
Now they had a machine, there was three paper making machines, MG means machine glaze, and it had a huge cylinder on it, and these were resin in the paper, and if you remember the brown paper years ago would have a shiny side on one side of it. Yeah. And the second machine was a Fortuneteer, and it would make toilet paper and make newsprint and stuff like that. And the third machine, number three, that come from Germany, it made our rough brown paper, you know, at the time. But there's no rough brown paper now at the moment, you know, with plastic bags and packaging and all that sort of thing. You know?
Did that kill it, you know, when all that plastic started to arrive?
I'd say that, and I'd say energy costs would have killed it, you know, and...
Yeah.
Did a lot of labour problems as well. Did a lot of strikes and things like that. And But I think that's the reason why Cusick asked us to take over the project engineering. They did a lot of the craft workers there. They will be sort of reasonably responsible for it, you know what I mean? Mm. High pay and all sorts of fancy rates and things like that, you know what I mean? And
so when you say that Dr. Cusick asked you to take over, in what capacity then? Take over what?
Project management of the installation and the construction of the machinery.
And you think that's the reason why? Because he was getting too much trouble from the workforce? Or from the...
I'm only estimating. I don't think... He was getting older himself as well, you know what I mean? And he was a hands-on type of... He's an engineer as well, you see, yeah.
Yeah, and so, but his great interest then in mechanical engineering was to the fore, you know.
Yeah, but I've seen photographs there of him there, that if there was concrete going in or anything, like, they wouldn't be beyond taking up a shovel or anything like that, you know.
Yeah.
There was a lot of engineers employed in the paper mills. And just every machine had an engineer. The boiler house had an engineer. The pulp plant, 5. There was like the engineer, 6. Chief engineer, 7. There was at least 7 engineers, qualified engineers now, you know, in the paper. It was, at that time, it was beginning to come real high tech, you know. Was I telling you about the drives and the computers and all that sort of thing, you know. And chemists as well. A couple of PhD chemists, Dr. Scanlon, Margaret Scanlon. Was that my name mentioned here?
Yes.
Yeah. And technicians. Yeah, quality control, you know what I mean, testing the water and testing the paper and anyway. See, when you're selling paper, you like to sell a drop of water with it as well. You know, the moisture content was very critical. Yeah, dry paper is very cheap, is very light, you see.
To make it a little bit heavier, yeah.
Yeah, I come across that a lot. I was in the... A little while in the textile industry in Bray, and they had air conditioning there, and they like to sell a sup of water with the bobbins of textiles they were doing. They were weaving. I think they used to make the dole, what I call tar cords, you know, before the steel come in, you know. Yeah. And it was rain, and they used to weave it, you know, but they like to. The moisture content was critical. Yeah.
How relaxed was the situation when you were there?
It was go all the time, and when there's a thing on the machine, a felt or a wire, and when that gave trouble, the wire was a phosphor bronze, endless wire. And there could be no marks or anything like that. I mean, that's the thing that the pulp was on. When that had to be changed, it would be expected to go down there and give a hand out to get... The two machines were quite close to one another, you know. And a lot of it was manual work, you know, taking off this wire without getting it damaged. Putting on another wire without damaging. And I'm not so sure there wasn't an alarm bell in Cusick's office when the wire was being done. The alarm went off, you know, because I was over in JCB in England. Do you know the JCB?
Yes.
I went over there on a visit for the army. And this man that owned the JCB was called John Charles Bamford. That's how JCB arrived. And in his office... was a bell, and if any part of the production line went down, that bell rang, and he was tearing baited. Different times now, you know.